This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Ladies and gentlemen,
can I please have your attention?
Can you dig it?
Greetings, dear listeners. This is Jonah Goldberg, host of the Remnant Podcast, brought to you by The Dispatch and Dispatch Media. You know, I've always emphasized the fact that I am not what one might call a professional broadcaster. But I have certain natural skills that just become readily apparent from time to time on this podcast. And so I've decided that the key here is to invite someone into the octagon who is worthy of my skills, that, or I might actually have to try this time, because I'm a famous underachiever who likes to say I didn't even try. And in that respect, I've gotten someone to come on here who is, let's just face it, he's old. He's really old. I looked it up. He was born a full 9 days before me in the same city I was born. And you may have heard of him from such after school films as Zinc and You, Partners in Freedom. But he is also occasionally on this network called CNN. He's a novelist. He's an anchor, longstanding journalist in, quote unquote, this town. Is my friend Jake Tapper. Jake, welcome back to The Remnant.
It's great to be here. Thank you so much. Hey, speaking of after school specials, did you ever see The Wave? Do you remember The Wave?
Probably, but I need more information.
So The Wave is based on a true story about a teacher in California, I believe, who tried to teach his students at the school about fascism. Uh-huh. And the way he did it was by creating a fake cult where people joined The Wave. And then at the end, he unveils their leader to them. And the leader, spoiler alert, the leader is a film of Adolf Hitler. And he has revealed to them how fascism can take root under the spirit of belonging and unity. It's a really interesting experiment and TV movie. And I don't know about the production values. It might be as bad as the girl that did LSD and jumped off the school roof one episode of whatever. But
wasn't that Helen Hunt?
I think it was. It might have been.
Yeah.
But in any case, it's worth checking out, especially as we're watching a whole bunch of our former friends and colleagues join the wave.
Yeah. All right. So we'll come back to that, because I have views on many of these things. But your handlers at CNN,
yes,
agreed to take off your pain collar for the purpose of talking about this new thing that you're doing. And I think we'll have things to talk about here. You're hosting a new series on a CNN original series called United States of Scandal.
I'm not just hosting it. I'm an executive producer as well. I've been involved in this.
That's why they took off the pain collars.
Yes.
It's a darkly comedic look at some of the wildest political scandals in the U.S. And you speak to a lot of the main characters, including Rod Blagojevich, Jim McGreevy, Valerie Plame, etc. So,
yes,
who are you going after the first one? Who are you profiling in the first one?
The first episode aired Sunday night, actually the first two episodes. And the first one was about Rod Blagojevich, mm-hmm, and the second one was about Mark Sanford. And we try to take a deeper look in addition to interviewing people who had an inside view of it, whether it is the most inside view, Rod Blagojevich's view, or we interviewed Mark Sanford's like top longtime aide who'd never done an interview before, giving his inside view perspective, as well as his communications director and others, talking about that scandal. And one of the things that we're trying to get into is just like the deeper significance of these scandals. Rod Blagojevich, for example, is, in his view, it's about the criminalization of politics. It's about the corrupt campaign finance system. Where did he cross the line, et cetera. For Mark Sanford, it's about personas, political personas. I'm making it sound intellectual because I'm trying to appeal to you, Jonah. But for people who are not so inclined, it's also just, these are also just fun yarns, and they're very well produced. And they did pretty well when we aired them Sunday night. Those first two, we won the demo against Fox and MSNBC, which is not insignificant. And other episodes coming up: McGreevy, Spitzer, Edwards. We had for the Edwards episode, we interviewed Rielle Hunter, his girlfriend. We have the Valerie Plame affair, which is a whole,
that's kind of complicated.
Anyway, it's fun.
So and can people catch them on streaming later? Just so for,
they have not been posted on CNN Max yet. Uh-huh. But they will be, I'm sure they will be re-airing and the like, because once something does well, CNN will air it again, et cetera, et cetera. But it's Sunday nights at 9. It's not just a cable rehash of a story you already know. It's like stuff you don't know and trying to put it in the context of, all right, we're in 2024. What was the significance of this event from 2009? Was there one, et cetera?
So, I was invited to the screening thing, and alas, I was on vacation and couldn't make it. Otherwise, I would have been there. But I will say I'm disappointed, even though it doesn't actually merit doing an episode on it. But do you remember the Josh Steiner episode?
Josh.
So it's totally forgettable, and it's totally unfair to him at this point, because he's like a grown-up human being who's like, he was one of the last guys in contention to buy the Washington Post or take over the Washington Post or something like that. And he's with Bloomberg Media, super rich guy, hedge fund, whatever. God bless. But in the 90s, when there was that Resolution Trust scandal thing about what the Justice Department knew about Whitewater, I mean, it got all really convoluted. I was trying to remind myself, when I realized that you're coming on today, I reminded myself of the story because it was opaque to me.
Oh my God, I have a vague memory of him, because I remember like Barbara Boxer coming to his defense.
Yeah, a lot of people came to his defense, right? He was one of like the wonder kids of the Clinton administration. He was the chief of staff of the Treasury Department. And he's the guy who claimed that he lied to his diary, which I always love that, right? It's very much like the what's his name? The tiny former commerce secretary or labor secretary, Robert Reich, right? Where he just kind of said, well, that's the way I remembered it. And that's all, right? It's like these people who, you know, come up with these novel explanations. But the telling detail was, remember the columnist Roger Rosenblatt? Ruth Shalit did a profile of all these wonder kids in the Clinton administration. And at the height of this scandal for Josh Steiner, he called Rosenblatt, who had been a family friend. And when they were little kids, Rosenblatt would sing him the Felix Cat theme song. And Steiner, in the middle of the scandal, called Rosenblatt, said, could you please sing me the Felix the Cat theme song?
Wow. Oh my God.
And for years now, me and my friends, whenever we're under a lot of stress and we want to give them the hard time, we'll be
like, Felix the Cat,
do you want me to sing the Felix the Cat song to you? That's the only reason I bring it up.
Well, so, you know, since by the way, I just looked it up, and the episode coming up this Sunday is the John Edwards episode. And like, sitting down with Rielle Hunter and having her tell that story is really interesting. And also just the profoundly amazing fact of that John Edwards was trying to get away with cheating on his cancer-stricken wife with this other woman, impregnating her, getting her and his top aide to say that it was the top aide's baby, and all of this stuff while he was running for president of the United States is just so head-blowingly amazing.
And what is John Edwards doing now?
Laying low. I think he's back to practicing law. You know, they tried him, and he was ultimately acquitted. I mean, I think the jury was hung for campaign finance violations. One of the things that's really interesting about the series is you realize how difficult it is to prosecute people for the scandalous behavior. It wasn't difficult for Rod Blagojevich, but for the people going after Rod Blagojevich, but Edwards, Pat Fitzgerald, who went after and, you know, who investigated the Valerie Plame leak. That's one of the most untold stories is, I mean, although conservatives I know it well, but like the idea that he knew from very early on who the leaker was, that it was Dick Armitage at the State Department, and then still did this 2-year investigation. And ultimately, the only person ever tried for anything was Scooter Libby for perjury. And that was based on him and Tim Russert having a disagreement about what was brought up in a conversation years before. So anyway, I digress.
Yeah. Now, I will say, like, I thought Bush was on the wrong side of the Scooter Libby question about, you know, commuting or pardoning or whatever the final question was.
You're not alone. Mr. Cheney feels the same way.
I gotta say, I, having been subpoenaed and deposed for the Dominion lawsuit, like, as you're probably more aware than I am, Washington, in fact, the CNN green room is often full of these peripheral characters from scandals who get called in because they're witnesses to something or they're a fact witness for this or whatever. And they got a lawyer up. And I have this like profound, newfound respect and sympathy for these bit, because I was a very bit character in the Dominion lawsuit. I mean, right. I really had nothing for them, but I had to lawyer up in all sorts of ways to protect the Dispatch about revealing sources, and it got really complicated. And my first meeting with the lawyer was a great lawyer, liked him a lot. I did the math though. I could have sat there lighting one $10 bill with the other for the hour and come out saving money.
It really is astounding. Yes. I mean, the degree to which this happens in Washington, and that one of the things that's amazing also about the Plame affair is this all began because of a green room encounter.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us the story about it, right?
So Robert Novak, the Prince of Darkness, conservative columnist, is at Meet the Press. And Joe Wilson is there. And he is out there with his op-ed, and he's talking about, to Novak's recollection, he's just talking about how much better the Clinton NSC was, the National Security Council was, than the Bush NSC. That's Novak. And Novak says in his memoir that he thought, quote, what an asshole. And then later, he has a meeting or phone call with Dick Armitage, who's the number two at the State Department under Colin Powell. This is in 2003, all of this. And he's like, why did the Bush administration send Wilson to Africa to check on this Niger uranium yellow cake story? And Armitage, this is according to Novak's recollection, just says like in an offhand kind of way, oh, that was the CIA. His wife works for the CIA on the counterproliferation desk. So ultimately, what happened was, even though there were other people in the Bush administration that leaked her name, Scooter Libby, Ari Fleischer, et cetera, the original leak was the product of this world that we live in, this green room world of people talking. And it wasn't that one leak does not appear apparently to be part of any conspiracy to necessarily discredit Valerie,
which was the charge all over the place, right? I mean, people lost their minds saying that this was an attempt basically to silence a whistleblower.
The narrative is the Bush administration was lying us into war, and Joe Wilson was this noble man who told the truth, and then the Bush administration, to get revenge, leaked his wife's name. That is not the full, whole, complete story and actual truth of what happened. What actually happened is a much more complicated story. I'm not saying it's any more flattering to anybody, including the Bush administration or the media, but the actual story is much more interesting and nuanced, and hopefully that's what we'll get to.
This raises an interesting question. So one of the overarching themes of this fully functional podcast is this idea that people get the thing, have it backwards about Washington most of the time. That all these people who, particularly in social media, but this goes back a long way, who think Washington is full of hyper-competent people doing conspiratorial, terrible things, right? When in reality,
yeah,
most of the time, nobody knows what the hell's going on. Yeah. Nobody, even if they do know what's going on, they have very little control of events outside of, you know, basically their email account, right? They can't like manipulate, you know, 4 degrees of, you know, of chess moves ahead about anything. Most of the people are well-intentioned, but not necessarily incompetent. Some are incompetent,
yeah.
But some are just not, there's no level of competence that can let you manipulate all of the political players and factors involved in these things and anticipate people's reactions to things.
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of curious, like, how often do you find when you're doing your whole, you know, run to the phone booth with your Clark Kent hat on stuff, where you actually find that it really is a simple tale of sinister people doing sinister things deliberately and with competence, right?
With the grand exception, of course, being Donald Trump in the election, which was,
yeah, for sure,
100% sinister people doing sinister things for sinister reasons, and a lot of it playing out right in front of our faces and some of it not. But that is the, you know, a huge exception. Generally speaking, people are motivated by doing what they think is best. A lot of people, the people who opposed the Iraq War and the people who supported the Iraq War, both thought that they were doing right. They thought, you know, like, and you can set, you can believe in the worst in your opponents all you want if you're a political player, but often the truth is not that. Most people that you're dealing with are not Marjorie Taylor Greene. You know, most people are not. There is a degree to which a lot of people in the today's political world are a combination of stupid and mean. But most people, I think, are not. Most people are cowardly, trying to get by, trying to do, you know, doing, making compromise A so that they can be around to do good for, you know, topic B.
Yeah. So I used to have this theory back in my younger, more exuberant, more team player days on the right. That the corruption of green rooms was a really pernicious thing. because what you would get is, and got to remember my formative experience, speaking of scandals, my formative experience of being thrown in the deep end of the pool of green rooms was the Clinton Lewinsky stuff, right?
Where, mine too, buddy.
Yeah, exactly. You know, where I had done some media, you know, prior as a little wonky think tank kid, but then all of a sudden I'm on Larry King like 4 nights a month kind of thing. And
Seattle, you're on the air. I get one of these microphones in front of my face and I just,
we can talk freely about Larry King at this point, right?
I didn't know him very well.
Nice enough guy, you know, whatever. Yeah. But like, do you remember the infomercials for GLH number 9?
No, what's that?
GLH stands for great looking hair.
Oh.
And it was that spray paint hair to cover stuff up.
I've seen that used in green room, in makeup rooms, not in green.
Yes. Yeah. Which for listeners, if you hadn't guessed, makeup rooms are usually very adjacent to green rooms.
By the way, that stuff works. It makes it look like people have hair where they don't have hair.
Yeah. Although I think HDTV.
Oh yeah.
Was a big blow to the end to the fake hair industry,
right.
Which it may never have recovered. And but anyway, I would go to these green rooms and Lanny Davis, right? Remember, you know,
sure.
Lanny Davis.
I just had him on my show last week to promote the Scandal series, just because he is the quintessential scandal whisperer. He's the one that can give you good advice,
right? Or that's the business that he's in.
Yeah.
We can have a debate about whether the advice is good, but like Lanny, and I'm happy to say this to his face, I get along with him fine. Everyone gets along with him fine in the green room. That's the thing that I always thought was so corrupting, was that he's a flatterer before the cameras get on. And then the cameras go on and he's like, I am just saddened and disappointed that someone with an integrity like you would say something like that, right? And you, over time, you were like, you don't want to piss off these people. You don't want to offend these people. You want to, and there's this corrupting thing that comes from hanging out in green rooms. And I still think that exists. And there are still creatures at every network who, you can always tell there's a certain kind of Washington creature who, after he does his TV hit, doesn't go home.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't see it much because you're off on the set the full time.
Yeah.
But like at Fox, there were people who had a hit at like 10:30 in the morning and you'd still see them there at like 2 p.m. holding court, giving out business cards or whatever. And anyway, I've kind of changed my mind a little bit about it. There's still the problems with green rooms, but it's the only place left, at least now that I'm at CNN, where you can actually have like legitimate conversations with people who are way outside your bubble.
Yeah.
And that's a really sorely missing thing these days.
Although I would say, I think that when you come on my show and you're on a panel, whether it's a two-person or a four-person panel, generally speaking, I think that you are having conversations with, like, you know, for example, Nayira Hawk, who you guys disagree on a lot, but you're outside your comfort zone. I'm not outside your comfort. You guys disagree, but you're doing so in a respectful
yeah,
way. Now, maybe the conversations are even more intense and more candid in the green room.
Well, you get to ask Democratic people stuff that they won't say on TV about Biden's age, about all sorts of things, right? And they get to ask me all sorts of things. It's like, it's amazing how many people have these views of Fox where they, you know, they just wonder, you know, they think it's like just strewn with, I don't know, like bloody chainsaws and 1920s surgical tables and torture chambers or something. It's like, no, it's not quite like that, you know? And anyway, it's an interesting exercise that I kind of, you know, I kind of value in a way that I used to have a straight green rooms are seductive, stay out of them, you know, get in, get out as quickly as you can because you'll grow as a conservative. And now I've got nothing, all my bridges are burnt. So I just feel free to whatever. Anyway, you were telling me on set a while back when you were planning this show or you're wrapping it up, the first one, that Blagojevich is completely unrepentant about what he did.
100% doesn't think he did anything wrong. He says in the show, I didn't do anything wrong. That doesn't mean I wasn't a f-ing idiot. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't think he did anything wrong. And, you know, I think that the evidence suggests otherwise. But we let Blagojevich, you know, we hand over the microphone and, like, tell us your story. And we let him make his case. I find some of it persuasive, most of it not. But it is, I think, interesting to, like, hear his point of view. The most repentant to me, and this is just a value judgment, seems Jim McGreevy, who we interviewed. And
what was McGreevy's scandal again?
His scandal was that, well, first, there are two. The one that everybody remembers is that he was a gay man who was living the life of a straight man. He was married with kids and the governor. And then, like, he comes out and admits he's a gay man. And he became this poster child for an anachronistic view of gays in public life. Mm-hmm. But the actual scandal was that he had hired his lover.
Who's like an Israeli security consultant or something?
No, he was just an Israeli. I don't think he had any security consultant expertise in particular, certainly not to be the Homeland Security advisor for the governor of New Jersey in the years after 9/11. He was not up to that task. And he had hired him and put him on the payroll. That was the actual scandal. Although, you know, McGreevy and the world would rather you prefer to remember, would prefer that you remember scandal number one. Isn't it horrible that he was a gay man that had to live a lie? And yes, it is. But that wasn't the actual scandal.
Yeah. I mean, there's something sort of Tom Wolfe-y about, you know, the retreat to high-minded victim narratives about identity politics when you did something corrupt.
Right.
Right. You know, it's sort of like, you know, wherever you come down on the Fannie Willis stuff, you know, the retreat to they're coming after me because I'm a black woman.
Yeah.
Is a very familiar PR strategy, whether she means it sincerely or not. Like the New York Times doing this thing about how, you know, this story is very familiar to black women. Well, like that kind of spin always kind of bothers me a little bit because it presupposes that the factual aspects of the accusations of Fannie Willis can't be true. And it has to be this larger sort of oppressor oppressed, you know, victim thing.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, I will say that it is true that Trump goes after critics who are female with, it seems like, an even more,
for sure,
vitriolic kind of bloodlust, and women of color even more so. I mean, the comments he has made about white male journalists who have challenged him versus the Abby Phillips or Yamiches or who, you know, it's just, he, you know, You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. I get that. Yeah, 100%.
Like, actually, I was thinking when I was watching Bonnie Wallace's testimony the other day, and like, who knows how this all plays out. I mean, she was giving very confident testimony suggesting that what she did, you know, that there was no actual inappropriate behavior in terms of public funds and this and that. We don't know what is going to emerge. I mean, if everything she was saying was true and there's no evidence to the contrary, that's, I mean, whatever. I know better than to say how it's going to end up this early in the phase of this particular controversy. But I was thinking, you know, we haven't had a good sex scandal for, you know, with where the woman is the public official, like in a long, long time in this country. And I'm already thinking about season two of United States of Scandal, like, you know, because like we have weapons of mass destruction / Valerie Plame / all that. And then we have the graft of Blagojevich. And then we have four lusts for these six episodes: Edwards, McGreevy, Spitzer, and Sanford. And like, that's a lot of lust. And we just don't get one with a woman protagonist. So, you know, we'll see what happens with her. But if everything she said was a lie, that would be a great one for second season two. I'm not holding my breath. We'll see what happens.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
So I didn't mean to steer us off of the Blagojevich thing, although I think actually you steered us off. I just want to just circle back on it. So I have some sympathy for Blagojevich's position, but I'm not exactly sure I'm understanding what he claims his position is. But so like, I mean, you've been to Afghanistan, you know Afghanistan better than I do and all that kind of stuff. But I know a lot of people who did development work there or State Department stuff and all that. And it's a big part of my last book is this argument that what we call corruption in the developed democratic West
right.
is actually the way human beings have done business for thousands of years, right? And you tell Afghans, oh no, you have to put this contract out for bid. And they're like, what are you talking about? Of course I'm going to give it to my cousin. You know, you're going to, what if someone from that tribe gets this bid? You know, that's crazy. And so what we call corruption is actually the natural way of doing things. And I think that we sometimes look at places like Chicago or Philly or New York and have this expectation that they're further along in democratic development than they actually are. And they actually, like, remember that LA story 6 months, a year ago about Hispanic lawmakers telling, saying terrible things, racial things bigoted things quietly, whatever. And I love the story, not because I like people saying terrible things about other people, but because it's a machine run liberal city. And this is the way ethnic groups in politics talk about each other for 200 years in America, right? And it's not necessarily that it's bigoted. It's more like, you know, the blacks want this, or the Jews are going after that in New York City contracting or whatever. And it's just factional talk. And so I'm kind of wondering if Blagojevich's crime isn't that he tried to sell a Senate seat, is that he didn't do it in a sophisticated way, right? I mean, like Bill Clinton wouldn't be on tape saying, I can't give this thing away for free, but he'd probably sell an Arkansas Senate seat if he could.
So there are two things on that. First of all, his argument is what I told you before, like, you know, I didn't commit any crimes, but I didn't say I wasn't a fucking idiot. And there is a point in the show where I say, like, why didn't you just talk about, you knew the FBI was going after you. Why didn't you just talk about these things more in a more sophisticated way? You know, we want to give the Senate seat to whoever deserves it. And separately, I don't want to be the governor anymore. And I would like to find something that I can do. But those two things are completely separate. And like, you know, you can say things like that. So he said, he said he granted my point. But beyond that are two points. One, he had a team of fundraisers who were corrupt. And his argument is, well, I didn't know that. And, you know, they had problems. And, you know, these guys were going to anybody who wanted anything from the city and basically saying, pay up. You know, it's Ray Liotta in Goodfellas. You pay me, like that. Mm-hmm. So that's one. And like, his downfall comes when a woman who runs a children's hospital who's trying to get permits does a sting operation, wears a wire, and gets these fundraisers, his fundraisers, in trouble. So that's one, you know, and he pleads innocent and ignorance and okay. The other thing is, and he compares himself, he brings up two things. One, Eisenhower getting Governor Earl Warren's support as in the Republican convention in 52. Earl Warren, the governor of California, and he promises his delegates to Eisenhower in exchange for Eisenhower making him not just a Supreme Court justice, but the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which happens mm-hmm. a year later. So that's one thing he compares himself to. And again, we let him give these history yeah. lessons. And the other one is, you know, horse trading is part of our life. Look how, you know, Abraham Lincoln got the Emancipation Proclamation passed. Okay. And I challenged him a little on that because I'm like, you're not comparing.
No, man. I mean, Blagojevich, Eisenhower, Lincoln, those names trip off the tongue altogether perfectly.
So what Eisenhower did, what was not illegal, what Lincoln did was not illegal, but what Blagojevich did was, and one of mm-hmm. the reasons was because he was very directly trying to find something that he would personally benefit from in a financial way post-governorship. Because remember, he wanted to resign as governor because the walls were closing in on him because of this FBI investigation into these corrupt fundraisers of his. And he wanted a lucrative job, whether it was with a nonprofit or whatever. So he was very definitely trying to quid pro quo the Senate seat, which is different than, you know, Lincoln engaging in horse trading to get slaves freed, or even Eisenhower, you know, and there's no paper trail of this, but Eisenhower saying, okay, Earl Warren, you know, fine, you know, and putting a governor who is a lawyer on the Supreme Court as the Chief Justice, that might not have been the best thing Eisenhower ever did. And certainly people who are not fans of the Warren Court would argue that he, you know, that was corrupt, but it's not like he wasn't qualified.
Right. And it's not like Eisenhower personally
benefited. Well, he did from the delegates, but
yeah, but like, I mean, like Blagojevich is right about politics being about horse trading and deal cutting. It's just not supposed to be about personal enrichment.
Right.
Right.
This is the argument that Menendez made in his first corruption trial, which he was acquitted of in a mistrial, I think, which is he has a friend who is really rich and has business before the state. And the friend benefits from being friends with the governor or a senator from New Jersey. And the friend and he and the friend are also friends. And they go on vacation together, et cetera, et cetera. And where's the line? Now, We'll see what happens in the second case. But look, it's the same thing that happened to Governor, was it Bob McDonnell in Virginia? Yeah. Like, there is a whole bunch of this stuff where prosecutors go after politicians for crossing the line, and ultimately the politicians get off. Whether the conviction is overturned, as happened with Governor McDonnell, or they're not found guilty, as happened with Senator Ted Stevens, I think, right? Mm-hmm. Wasn't he ultimately acquitted even after?
He was. That was a pretty outrageous case.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of this and a lot of people claiming the criminalization of politics. And the truth of the matter is that our laws are vague. So, I mean, but that said, I mean, I don't buy Blagojevich's explanation, but we allow him to make it.
My favorite thing, I think I might have said this on your show, but like my favorite thing about the Menendez thing is when, you know, I was saying earlier about retreating to sort of identity politics kind of arguments, right? So he tried to do this thing where he
Latino.
Said,
yeah, being a Latino.
I was a Latino, his family's history in Cuba, but that's why I had these stockpiles of cash because I knew I needed to be able to, you know, that the government could take my money. And the thing I loved about it is he was right. The government took his money. The government went into his house and took his money. And he was criminal. You know, he shouldn't have had it, but like, you know, they took his gold bars.
By the way, somebody asked me why all of the scandals I have in season one of the show are between 2000 and 2015. And there are a couple of reasons. One of them is after Trump came along in 2015, like, it's really everything changed. And but beyond that, I actually wanted to do AbScam. And some of the players from AbScam, that's a bribery case for those who don't know, bribery case involving members of Congress. They made a movie, American Hustle, out of it with Bradley Cooper and the one of the Batman. Christian Bale. And anyway, I wanted to do that. And Ozzie Myers, who was my congressman at the time, as a little boy growing up in Philadelphia, and was one of the AbScam scammers and went to prison, I believe, is alive and well. And we were talking to him about it. And then he went to prison for something else. So we had to cancel the AbScam episode. He went to prison for, he was trying to fix a judicial election in Philadelphia. But hopefully when he gets out, we can revisit.
I don't know. Like, I mean, it's been 25 years since I was a television producer, but, you know, prison interviews are just good TV. Like, you know, he's setting up in the cafeteria kind of thing. It's worth thinking about.
I really grew up in an area in Philly, South Philadelphia. The actual neighborhood's Queen Village. It's kind of like right between posh Center City and gritty South Philly is this little area called Queen Village. And like so many people that represented me and my family growing up were ultimately went to prison. It's just, the names that won't mean anything to, except for the five Philadelphians listening, Buddy C and Franny, Vince Fumo. I mean, like we really had a rogues gallery.
You must be so proud. You entered Trump into the conversation here, so or introduced Trump. So let's do this. Are we ever going to be able to talk about like scandalous behavior and it matter anymore?
I think so. It does seem like there's a carve out for him among his supporters and those who feign supporting him in order to preserve their jobs as Republican officials. But I don't think it's transferable in the same way that his when he's not on the ballot, his people don't turn out. I don't think it's transferable. And one of the ways you can look at it is look at George Santos, you know, and Santos was expelled. And that's a very rare thing. And he was expelled by a Republican House. And, you know, so there, I mean, you know, it took Santos to having committed fraud against the grandmother of, you know, a Republican congressman, Max Miller. But that said, There still are standards, and I don't think he's changed the rules for everybody. I think he's changed the rules for himself. I think he didn't invent the I'm not resigning thing. Clinton did it, as you know. David Vitter did it. Like, it is a way to do it. Al Franken, in the view of many Democrats, should not have resigned. And I do think that he could have stayed and fought and or said, like, I'm going to learn from this experience, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, there is an argument to be made that Trump has changed the rule book, but I don't think it worked. I don't think it applies. You can't just like transfer it now.
Yeah. I mean, and that's also true politically in the sense that like, I mean, as you say, his people don't turn out except when he's on the ballot. Remember in 2018, Bannon put all those sort of Trump mini-me's trying to challenge McConnell and the establishment and all that nonsense. And they all failed. And then in 2022, the only one who succeeded was Vance, right? Or no, I should say, yes, it was Vance.
Because he was the only one running in a non-battleground state, right? I mean, any Trump primary endorsee running in a state where, you know, there is a thriving Democratic Party. So including Georgia, including Arizona, not including Ohio, lost. They all lost. But J.D. Vance is running in Ohio, which is, it's a red state. I mean, Sherrod Brown kind of has a special relationship with the people of that state that allows him to get reelected. And although who knows what's going to happen this year. But that said.
And the governor got reelected by 30 points and Vance won by like 8.
Yeah.
So like it shows you that the Trumpy stuff was still a drag on it. But and so, I mean, you're one of these, you know, fancy pants journalists who wears belts and stuff, and I'm one of these crazy right wingers, but like I am coming around to the view that it's very difficult for people to sustain cynical BS for very long before they start believing it, right? No one likes to tell themselves that they're lying. And so, like, what started in 2016 as a transactional thing with Trump, for a lot of people now is a true believer thing. Maybe not, you know, like, I firmly believe, whether this is a harsher criticism or a damning with faint praise thing, for, like, I don't think Tim Scott believes the things he says about Donald Trump. But, like, for the most part, a lot of these people believe the crap that they're saying at this point. And I could live with it for a while because most of it was about BS politics stuff. But now it's like the Ukraine situation is very, very, very bad.
And it's dangerous, right?
Yeah. Like, NATO is in trouble. This Navalny stuff is bad. And a lot of people on the right now think that this is what you're actually supposed to believe. And that's going to take a while to unwind, if ever.
It's not just that they think it's what you're supposed to believe. They are willing to try to look for reasons why they are acting against their own principles. And you see this with people who are Republicans, who are strong supporters of NATO, big opponents of Putin's Russia, trying to justify not passing aid to Ukraine by looking at the southern border and saying we need to solve that problem. Yes, the southern border is a mess. Obviously that's a big problem. To say we're not going to send money to Ukraine until we solve this problem that nobody has been able to solve in any way for decades is setting yourself up to not provide funding for Ukraine, which has actual life or death consequences. Liz Cheney was on my show Sunday on State of the Union, and she was very restrained in her criticism of Speaker Johnson, but basically was trying to appeal to him to bring the foreign aid bill that the Senate passed onto the floor of the House for a vote. Even though, as I pointed out, that will mean that members of the House Freedom Caucus challenge his speakership. And she basically said, like, there are things that are more important than being Speaker of the House, and history is going to judge him. Now, how much Speaker Johnson heard that message, I don't know, A, that he was watching CNN, B, I don't think that the incentives that motivate Liz Cheney are not the incentives that motivate Mike Johnson. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I think that's a really easy thing for me to say. I think you're right about it.
That's a polite thing to say.
Yeah, that's very polite. Because you want, you know, Speaker Johnson to come on your show.
He'll come on the show. I don't think he'd disagree with that notion. But I think she is playing she's looking to history. How am I going to be remembered?
Your diplomatic statement reminds me and some friends, colleagues back in the NR days, we used to joke around about coming up with phrases that sounded like you were complimenting people, but really weren't. And so with the changing nature of the GOP, and so like the only one I really remember is, with the election of Ted Cruz, the Republican Party finally has the leadership it deserves.
I was calling for McConnell for new leadership the other day because of the border fracas, because of what happened with Lankford. That's another great example of trying to find reason to stand with Donald Trump on something that you actually disagree with him on. It's been remarkable to watch. Like that, you and I know this. That is one of the most conservative border bills. You can take issue with it, this, that, whatever, but like one of the most conservative border compromise bills that has ever passed the Senate, period. It had nothing that the Democrats normally press for, like path to citizenship for the Dreamers and this and that. And the contortions about trying to figure out ways to like oppose it are just remarkable.
What I found remarkable were the number of people who said things like Lankford needs to resign.
Oh God.
Because of this horrible tragedy, you know, this horrible collaboration with the enemy. And it's also unbelievably stupid.
It's also like Senator Rubio brought up on my show, like his opposition to the fact that people who get asylum ultimately get on a path to citizenship. But he wasn't part of the negotiation. And it's like, I mean, they made it tougher to get asylum. That's what the bill would have done. And part of me was thinking, and I didn't say it because we didn't, you know, you don't have enough time to say everything you want, but like, so offer an amendment.
Have a hearing.
You can get asylum, but you can't vote. I mean, like, if that's really your issue, a lot of these people, you know, are coming here because they're about to be killed or whatever. The ones who get asylum on a legitimate basis, they're political prisoners or whatever. Like, okay, so offer an amendment saying they can't vote. Like, I mean, like, whatever, like, offer us, what's the solution to the, to your opposition?
Yeah. I mean, but there it's, I mean, it's all pretextual, right? It's Trump doesn't want it. So right. Then you have to just grab something. But I mean, I will say it's very frustrating for me because I think Joe Biden has abused his power, exceeded his constitutional authority on all sorts of things. And whenever I say that about student loans, rent, a moratorium, all that kind of stuff. I think that stuff is lawless and unjustifiable in constitutional terms. And every conservative in the world agrees with me on that.
Yeah.
And then they'll say Biden has the power right now as president to do all these things at the border, and he's just refusing to do them. And the problem is that he doesn't, right? And so, like, this tendency to think that the Constitution restricts presidents only on the policy areas that you care about.
Or that you agree with them on.
It's infuriating. And that has not really gotten, you know, I mean, like, if Biden had all the power to do this right now and that, you know, all this stuff wasn't, and the Lankford thing wasn't necessary, why didn't the House pass a really tough piece of immigration?
Right. Why HR2? Why are you passing HR2 if Biden has all the power? So it's such a great question. And you know, there are things, obviously, that Biden could do to make it tougher to get in this country. Like, he could bring back the Remain in Mexico policy. I mean, there are
things. Although Mexico has to go along with that, right? That's one of the things people keep saying is, you should bring that back. It's like, well, okay, go convince Mexico to be in favor of that.
Yeah, but there are things. But as you point out, like, if you don't, if all the power is in the executive branch, A, stop complaining when he does things in the, when he asserts executive privilege that you don't like, or executive powers that you don't agree with, and B, why did you pass HR2?
Right. Right.
And there's no, we're not in a place where people even like feel the need to give a honest answer. The honest answer to so many of these things on the, there's the liberal side and the conservative. So first of all, on the liberal side, like, we, for years, liberals in Washington have been saying there is no border crisis. This is just Republican racism. And that's not true. I mean, there is Republican racism, but like, there is a border crisis. You have millions of people coming into this country illegally. It creates a major drain on resources, as people in blue cities are now encountering because of whatever you think of it, the stunt that Governor Abbott and to a lesser degree Governor DeSantis did, sending them to New York, Denver, et cetera. Second of all, So that's the liberal thing. The conservative thing is, you're not passing this because Donald Trump wants it as an issue for November. That's the bottom line. You don't want Joe Biden to be able to say, I met with Republicans and I did this compromise. And you don't want the problem to be better. You don't want it alleviated. You want it to be horrible, which is so manifestly awful when you think about all the life and death issues that Republicans and people at the border have brought up that are legitimate human trafficking, the danger of the trek, all that stuff. Not to mention the, obviously, some of the people that get into this country are criminals, et cetera. But like, all of that is legitimately horrible. Now you want to keep it going. You want the status quo to go because of the bill isn't perfect or because Donald Trump wants the issue.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the frustrations. Like, you know, I was at National Review for 20 years. We were pretty hard line on the immigration stuff. I was a little squishier than some of my colleagues, but I was generally sympathetic to their editorial point of view on this stuff. One of the frustrations is that, like, they're doing this because Trump wants the issue, but I'm not sure. The problem is that I'm not sure it's a smart play, right? I mean, like, if they actually passed it and agreed to it, and then if Biden didn't follow through and actually do the things they want him to do, he'd be in more trouble politically. And if he did the things that they want him to do, Congress would be, the Republicans would say, see, we made him do it. But instead, it's this kind of like, Trump has a theory that this is what he needs. And so they decide to be blindly loyal to a bad theory about strategy. And anyway.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I do want to veer. We don't have a lot much time left. So, look, I've been at CNN now coming up on 2 years.
And I played a role in bringing you. And I'm so happy. And I hope you feel that you're being treated right. And that, you know.
I appreciate it. And I am. Generally, it's been a pretty great experience so far. And we can talk about the exceptions to the rule off camera. but that said, one of the things I find super frustrating, and I just assume you have it at much larger scale, is that I will hear constantly from people about how crazy left-wing CNN is. And there are usually two explanations for it. One is they saw some clip on Newsmax or Fox or wherever, of some nutpicking thing where they take one thing out of context and they say, okay, now that's what the whole network is like.
Right.
Or two, they've just been told by people that CNN is crazy left-wing by Greg Gutfeld or by somebody, and they actually don't watch it at all.
Just so you know, people do that on the left too.
Oh, for sure. Like Fox is not, daytime Fox, news side Fox, is not nearly.
No, I just mean like there's this progressive alternate to Twitter called Blue Sky that I joined and then it just became just as nasty a place, except on the left, from the left, and whatever. I just poked my head in yesterday just to see, because I haven't posted for months, and I posted and I was like, oh, people accusing me of supporting genocide, you know, whatever, just that sort of thing. It's like, you don't watch CNN, you don't watch my show. Like, we have pieces from Gaza talking about how awful it is for innocent people in Gaza. Like, I mean, so little of this has anything to do with reality.
Yeah. I mean, I think cable news is a mixed bag for American politics, but it is what it is. It's there. Right. And that said, like, it's not, cable news doesn't drive narrative anymore. It's fitting into people's narratives. Right. And so they just assume, like, they just have just stories about how the media controls everything, but they don't actually pay attention to the media. They don't watch it. They don't read it. It's like, I remember my first glimpse of this was 15 years ago, where I was speaking at a very right-wing group in Southern California, and people came up to me afterwards and said, you know, it'd be so great if the LA Times would carry your column, but they'd never do that. And I was like, well, I've been in there for like 4 years at this point. And they were like, oh, well, I canceled my subscription years ago.
Did they run your column before it was even syndicated? I mean, like...
I've been in the LA Times for like 17 years.
Yeah, and that's why I first read you.
My point is that they have a theory of what the media is doing. Like, all these people saying how bad the New York Times is, and I have lots of good criticisms of the New York Times, but I actually read it. Most of the people who talk about like the New York Times or CNN or on the left know about Fox. Either they only see these tiny little snippets or they don't see it at all. And that makes it, it's an exceedingly frustrating thing. And so one of the things I keep trying to tell people is watch CNN, you know, watch Tapper, watch Wolf, you know, watch some of the news shows and get back to me. Because I keep running into people saying, well, the media won't cover how old Joe Biden is. And it's like, I'd say it's like one in five times I'm on one of these shows, it's a major topic of conversation.
I was covering it in 2020. I mean, like, yeah, this isn't, yeah.
And it's like, they're just trying to keep it a secret. It's like, what secret? This is the worst kept secret in American public life.
No? It is, look, I mean, one of the things about media criticism in this day and age is, A, there are actors who are incentivized to just, their entire raison d'etre is to criticize media. So like, I used to think that Media Research Council and Newsbusters, I used to think that they were fairly interesting and informative and like actually made me reconsider the way things were taught, reported sometimes. But now they say things that are just aren't true. I mean, I see it or like they'll take one snippet of something and ignore 5 months of everything else. Like it's, there is so little, I don't mean to pick on Newsbusters, although I don't feel bad for them for being picking on them, but like Fox, Newsmax, OANN, if that still exists, all these organizations are, their whole business plan is the other guys are lying and not telling you the whole story. And that depends. So everything they sent, like one time Hannity did a monologue about me and he like acted as if an interview I had done with Jake Sullivan was, he was defending Jake Sullivan, just like, because that's the business plan, right? He was defending Sullivan and acting as if I hadn't asked about the hostages. This is like, I feel like this is October or November of last year. And I had done a whole thing about the hostages in that interview, but he didn't care. I don't even think if he probably didn't even know. It was probably just like some snip operator on his show who just put it in there. So there are two problems. One, there is an entire group of people who are out there to discredit the media. This exists to a lesser extent on the left. I don't think it's as bad, but maybe I'm wrong. But like I think Media Matters has had its moments of excess, but generally speaking, I don't think they're, I used to think they were worse than Newsbusters. Now I think they're much more reality-based. They go back and forth. But you know, you can read Olbermann tweets all you want, but that's not the same thing as an entire network the way Fox is. So that's a problem. And then the other problem is the balkanization of media and audiences and the degree to which people for business plans to keep their media organizations alive are have a preaching to the choir mentality that is unhealthy for journalism, unhealthy for democracy. I get attacked for even having you on my show. You know, I get attacked for interviewing Republicans because people who watch maybe another channel never have to watch any Republican ever being interviewed except for Steve Schmidt and Charlie Sykes, you know, and like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I would make, I mean, if we had more time, I'd make the argument that, because I used to be the right wing house goy at Brill's Content. Do you remember Brill's Content?
Yeah.
And I used to do, and I would do it up against this guy from Fair, which I don't know if it still exists.
It still does.
Fairness, yeah. And accuracy.
They're not fans of mine either.
And I think that generally the left-wing media criticism has to be so far left to find purchase, because I do think just the mainstream media, to the extent that's a phrase that has,
yeah,
you know, explanatory power anymore, is left of center. And so you have to be way left of center to think that like everything you see on CNN is right wing, or that you that Chuck Todd is a crazy right winger, right? And so meanwhile, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit if you're a right-wing full-time media critic about stuff that's in the center. My criticism of the MRC guys and the Newsbuster guys is they used to be extremely useful when they were strictly concentrating on actual reporting, right? When they're going after people for factual reporting bias kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Now they're like, can you believe what this left-wing pundit said on a left-wing opinion show? And I was like, yes, because that's what left-wing pundits say on opinion shows. And like, opinions are not like something to get freaked out about. Everyone's got them. And there are right-wingers with crazy opinions and left-wingers with crazy opinions. And that's not media criticism anymore. That's just holding up someone like a Medusa's head and saying, see, look how crazy these people are.
Exactly. Yeah, no, agreed. And, you know, the media criticism I find the most informative and illuminating is that which introduces facts or counterfactuals to make me reconsider the way a story is being reported, or even more so perhaps somebody who says, why aren't you covering this story, which is a story that is not getting covered enough. An example, and this is actually from the left in a way, is that there was a horrible incident in Tennessee the other day where a police officer arrested some woman for like disorderly conduct or whatever. And then he was texting while he was driving and he drove his car into a lake or a river and he killed himself and the woman. And it's just this horrible tragedy. And the way that the police announced what happened was very like police officer tragically dies, very ignoring of the woman. And, you know, this was the mom of two kids and like she didn't, you know, like arguably like why was she arrested? And it was just very, it was a, just a very, you know, there's this thing called copaganda where people who like want to challenge the police, like look at the way that we cover the police, we in the media cover the police, in which they criticize the media. And I hear this criticism as, you know, like using terms like officer involved shooting. And it's like, you're right. That is a good point. That is a bullshit term. It's obfuscatory. It doesn't mean anything. You know, are you saying that a cop killed somebody? Because to say that, I mean, anyway, that stuff is helpful, whether from the left or from the right. I find that stuff helpful. And I find, okay, did you, but you know, like, I feel like on the Valerie Plame thing, just to go back to our series, like at the end of the day, the people who leaked her name were Dick Armitage, who was a skeptic of the war in Iraq, who worked for Colin Powell, who was a skeptic of the war in Iraq, to Robert Novak, who was a skeptic of the war in Iraq. He was against the war in Iraq. He said they didn't have WMD and it wasn't international interest. Those facts do not eliminate the fact that other people leaked her name too, and Karl Rove and whoever else that did it, Libby, whoever, shouldn't have done it, and like she shouldn't have been punished and all that stuff. But that those facts don't fit in with the narrative. And that makes it more interesting, the truth, but also really kind of gets at what our job needs to be, which is just calling balls and strikes and letting people understand what's going on.
All right, that's as good a place as any to get you out of here on time. I hope you'll come back.
Anytime.
You know, I wanted to circle back to the, because you brought up this whole fascist after school special thing.
The Wave. Google
the
it.
The Wave. You know, I'm not a big fan of the New Deal. I think there were some similarities with what was going on in Europe at the time. And one of the things I disliked the most about the New Deal was this thing called the Blue Eagle program, which was this rah-rah nationalist program that basically indoctrinated kids in schools, had military parades around the country. I can give you chapter and verse on it. And something I've always been meaning to point out to you is that is where the Philadelphia Eagles get their name.
Is that true?
From this, yes, from this fascistic New Deal program called the Blue Eagle. And I'll send you some paperwork on this. But
Eagle helmet right there, Eagle ball right there, another Eagle helmet right there, confetti from the Super Bowl in 2018 right there. You're calling me a fascist, and I will.
No, I'm pointing out that there's a troubling history here, but at the same time, this is one of these things that Americans need to come to grips with, is that you can have bad things in the past and imbue new meaning into these things that doesn't necessarily make you a, you know, doesn't, like, you didn't know, right? So, like the whole structural racism thing says that you had perfect knowledge about the legacy of the Blue Eagle, and, you know, you didn't, and that's fine.
I did not know, but that does not change my mission, which is to make sure that both Kelce brothers marry Taylor Swift during the next Super Bowl, and as they do, endorse Joe Biden, as is my instructions from the deep state.
That's right. And while self-vaccinating.
Well, clearly they're going to have vaxes, right, going on.
Maybe they should have drones sprinkle vax on the fans, you know, so they can
drones and black helicopters and tinfoil, everything, just break it all out.
All right, Jake Tapper, thanks so much for doing this, and we'll have you back.
Thanks.
Okay, so Jake Tapper has left the studio, and it was good to have him back on. Hopefully we'll get him back on some more. I should note, as just sort of a commercial, you know, he was here to promote his thing, which does, I'm sorry I missed the first episode, does sound pretty great. He was telling me some stories out of school about it. It's called The United States of Scandal. It premiered last Sunday, but it'll be on every Sunday through March 24th. You know, some of the stuff he was talking about calling balls and strikes and all that kind of thing. And that's one of the reasons why we launched The Dispatch. We kind of think the balls and strikes model is It's a useful metaphor. It's a useful way of thinking about things, but it's not entirely satisfactory. And so one of the things that we like to do is be completely honest about where our priors are and all these things. We're a right-of-center news outlet, and we don't deny it, but we also are pretty passionate about not carrying water for anybody, and we call BS on Republicans all the time. And we try to make the best arguments possible in our opinion side or analysis side, but we're fact-driven more than anything else. And if you're new to this podcast or if you're not a subscriber, please check us out at thedispatch.com, and we think you'll like we think the subscription is a really phenomenal value, and it is we provide something that is sorely missing out there. And with that, thanks again to Jake for coming on. And I'm home alone. My wife's out of town, so I'm just dealing with dogs and cat and drama. And I'll see you next time.
No, you won't. This is a podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.